You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Guy Delaunay.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Ben, what stories should we keep our eyes open for today?
Today the theme is boycotts. Should Putin be boycotted by Obama at the G20? Should German ministers and politicians boycott the Sochi Olympics over gay rights? And Israeli ministers plan to boycott the EU?
Also on the show, Angela Merkel is a morally bankrupt, policy-stealing manipulator. Well, that's according to her election opponents anyway. We'll ask if getting dirty is going to work out for the SPD.
Talking about getting dirty, we'll take a stroll around the streets of London to explore the reasons for the city's walking boom.
I think London's got some great streets to walk in, some great architecture, beautiful parks, really interesting street life and kind of character on the streets, which means it's a really interesting place to walk.
We'll also be getting an architectural tour of Gezi Park, the heart, of course, of the Turkish protests.
The government is very talented and very conscious about the use of catchy words like pedestrianization. Yes, it sounds very good, but the actual project was not a pedestrianization project at all.
And we'll stay in Turkey to check in with our man in Istanbul. We'll leaf through the British newspapers and we'll play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Guy Delaunay, you're here. Normally you're in Belgrade, but you're here at the moment in London. What's going on?
I'm getting soaked is what's happening, leaving Belgrade in the middle of a 40-degree heat wave.
Lovely.
And coming here wearing suede shoes, bringing nothing else for my feet.
Oh, dear.
And one trip to Richmond Park later.
I'm sorry about that. And I'm sorry for your suede shoes.
I'm very sorry for them. They were lovely.
It sounded like inappropriate footwear to be honest.
Which has been pointed out to me gleefully by my wife.
Okay. Guy is normally our man in Belgrade, but here for a week, and you're presenting Midori House all this week, are you?
Midori House all this week, and a bit of globalist action as well.
Ooh,
on Thursday and Friday.
The globalizers will get a piece of you as well. What fun. Okay, we will start, as ever, with the news. Barney Burnham's here.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. It's claimed that a series of American embassy closures in the Middle East and Africa was prompted by an al-Qaeda threat picked up through intercepting messages between terrorist commanders in Yemen and Pakistan. The New York Times says the intercepted messages were between Osama bin Laden's successor and the head of al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula. US lawmakers said the threat was the most serious in years, but White House spokesman Jay Carney wouldn't be drawn on the claims at a press briefing on Monday night.
I'm not in a position to discuss specific intelligence, but we believe that this threat is significant and we are taking it seriously for that reason and have taken the actions that the State Department announced out of an abundance of caution and will continue to monitor this and take action as necessary.
Three people have been killed and three others wounded after a gunman fired on a public meeting in a government building in rural Pennsylvania. Police say the suspected gunman, Rockney Newell, who's 59, was arrested at the scene. State Police Captain Edward Hoke says Newell arrived outside the building shortly after 7:15 p.m. and began firing a long gun through the windows of the hall where the meeting was being held.
He continued to advance on the building, firing as he walked forward, firing through the windows. He subsequently then entered the building, continuing to fire the long gun as he made his way through the building. At some point, he then exited the building and returned to the parking lot where he retrieved a handgun from his vehicle. He then again reapproached the building and entered the building again firing the weapon and was subsequently tackled and brought to the ground by two individuals who were inside the township building.
A Sudanese soldier has been killed in a clash with soldiers from South Sudan. An official statement said the clash took place after a South Sudanese patrol crossed the border and opened fire. It happened at Sudan's main oil field in the border area of Heglig, north of Sudan, and which, although is under the authority of Sudan, is also disputed with South Sudan. Sudan is the only conduit for South Sudan's oil exports, and it threatened to shut down its pipelines by the end of July unless the Juba government gave up its support for rebels operating across their border. The founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has agreed to buy the newspaper assets of the Washington Post for $250 million. The surprise deal follows the New York Times' sale of the Boston Globe for $70 million and is a further indication of the unprecedented challenges newspapers face as advertising revenue and readership both decline. Washington Post chairman and chief executive Donald E. Graham, whose family owns the paper, said it would be better served with another owner. In a letter published on the Post's website, Bezos promised no radical change. John Carroll, a mass communications professor at Boston University, told Monocle 24 it'll be interesting to see just what he does.
There have been instances where new owners have come in and sunk significant money into the print division or the print aspect of the newspapers. It's unclear whether Jeff Bezos is going to do that. My guess would be that he would lean in a more digital direction and try to maximize his revenues from there.
Police in the Canadian province of New Brunswick say a snake has escaped from a pet shop and strangled two young boys, believed to be brothers aged 5 and 7. The boys have been staying in a friend's apartment above the shop in Campbellton. Police say the snake slipped out of its cage and wriggled through the ventilation system. It has since been captured. Officials say they believe it's an African rock python. The shop owner says he's had it since 2001. The deputy mayor of Campbellton says the entire town is in shock. The highest paid pair in the American Baseball League, New York Yankees Alex Rodriguez, has been suspended for a record 211 games for alleged doping offences. Another 12 players, including 3 All-Stars, were handed 50-game suspensions by Major League Baseball following a long investigation into links between top players and a Florida clinic accused of supplying performance-enhancing drugs. Rodriguez was banned until the end of the 2014 season. It's estimated that the ban could cost him around $35 million. He says he'll appeal against the sentence. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Barney. It's 7 minutes past 8 in the morning here in London. None of us on performance-enhancing drugs.
No, very little for me. I mean, I kind of think that they should have certain sports where they just say, all right, free reign, baseball, cycling, take whatever you like and let's see how fast you can go and how far you can hit it.
Would you pay to see that?
Absolutely. Imagine the number of home runs. It would be amazing. How quickly they climb those mountains.
But to be fair, we did actually have that in the 1990s in American baseball, and now people complain that that was the tainted era and everything's got asterisks next to it and you can't trust anything.
Oh, that's it. I suppose it's hard to be get the greatest number of X's in a particular year if you're comparing it to some dodgy period, right?
And that's it. And that's where this whole thing with A-Rod, as he is known, Alex Rodriguez.
Is that right?
Yeah, A-Rod.
Oh,
and it sounds like somebody who's come to sort out your toilet, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I look forward to that. At least he's got the medicine cabinet to do it properly. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26.
From London,
London, London,
Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. We're live from Studio One here in London. And it's time to set the day's news agenda. 3 stories you need to know for today. And to help us do that, Ben Judah's here. He is author, of course, of Book Plug Approaching, Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. And Ben is a friend of the show. How are you?
Very well.
Just been on holiday, but you're back.
Indeed. And the theme of my stories today is boycotts.
Okay.
There's been growing clamour in the Western press, which has been responded by growing fear in the Russian press, that maybe Obama, in his journey to Moscow in September for the G20 hosted by Russia, might boycott a meeting with Putin in protest over the Edward Snowden affair. Edward Snowden, who's, of course, mm-hmm. the American spy who's just been given asylum in Russia for 1 year.
Well, they want us to call him a spy, don't they? But lots of people just want to call him a whistleblower.
That's true. But in Russia, he's being referred to as CIA operative, Edward Snowden. Yes. Even though he would say he wasn't actually a CIA operative, he was an NSA contractor, and now he's a whistleblower. But that's what he's being referred to in the Russian media. So there's growing concern. There's been calls from various senators, calls from right-wing publications, calls from congressmen that Putin has gone too far on Snowden, too far on Syria, and that Obama should snub him at the G20.
Has anybody actually suggested that what Obama could do would be just to stay in the airport terminal building?
Not yet. Even though there have been some very famous negotiations in Russian history that took place at airport terminals. So a little known fact is that in the mid-60s, Communist China and the Soviet Union actually went to war for a number of weeks in Manchuria, and the negotiations that took the two superpowers from the brink of nuclear holocaust did take place in an airport terminal, in which Zhou Enlai refused to meet Kosygin, the Soviet premier, in anything else but these kind of rickety little benches in Beijing airport.
Extraordinary details you've got sort of lodged in the back of your mind, Ben. That's wonderful. If we return to this Obama-Putin sort of question mark, I mean, Jay Carney, the White House spokesman, has... He's not exactly tried to sort of smooth the situation over. He said, in fact, Snowden isn't the only thing we disagree about. There are other problems as well. And he's talking about Syria and various other things. So clearly not a great amount of enthusiasm in the White House for selling this relationship in a different way.
But there's a lot of frustration because when Obama came to power, he pushed this reset policy. And the vision is that Russia was one of the many things that Bush had kind of screwed up with outdated Republican view of the world. And that he was going to kind of take the ideology out of the relationship with Russia and try and focus on core cooperative tasks. But what I think Obama has found out, much to his displeasure, is that Russian foreign policy is basically a bubble for domestic consumption, and that when something comes Putin's way, he will spin it as far as he can on Russian television to convince 100 million Russians glued in front of state-controlled propaganda television that he is indeed the superpower leader. And Syria and Edward Snowden have been the perfect TV opportunities for Putin to show himself as fighting off the West as his popularity declines inside the country.
So does his reset need a reset?
I'm not sure that spending lots of time trying to find new ways of dealing with Russia is worthwhile. I think that US foreign policy energy is better expended elsewhere. I don't think much can be achieved with it. So I think instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, Western leaders should just kind of pull back. Let go less, ignore Russia a bit, offer less big deals. Because there are whole ministries in Europe, there are all these forces in the Action Service, in Brussels, in Washington, trying to reinvent new ways to engage Russia. And I think, well, just engage a little less.
And because you think as far as you're concerned, that Russia's playing a game with slightly different rules, that Putin is interested in how his policy abroad plays domestically. And that's the only thing he's interested in.
Pretty much so. I think that's the only thing that Putin's sort of really interested in at the moment. And I don't think the West is going to get results equivalent to the amount of effort put in.
Okay. There is plenty to say on the Russia-America issue.
There's lots of meat in the issue, isn't there?
Well, very good. Very good. We should probably talk about another story that you've brought to our attention today. And this is the issue of the Israeli settlers and their sort of relationship with the EU and all the various developments on that recently.
Well, this is a fascinating story, which is that one of the big stars of Israeli politics in the past few years has been Naftali Bennett, who is the new leader of the settler movement and the settler party.
He was the leader of Jewish Home.
Yes, that's right. And Mr. Bennett has branded himself to appeal beyond the traditional base of what's called the hilltop youth in the West Bank by posing as a tech entrepreneur, an English speaker, somebody who's like as comfortable with Twitter and YouTube as he is with reclaiming the messianic promise of land in the hills of Judea. And Mr. Bennett is feeling himself under pressure, which is that since Netanyahu has relaunched peace talks with the Palestinians under intense American pressure, he is starting to feel superfluous to the coalition, is very fearful that if negotiations approach a point of no return, he'll either be dropped and replaced by some of the many left-wing parties in opposition to Netanyahu's Likud, or he'll simply be outvoted in a new law passed by the government, which is that any peace treaty would have to be ratified by a referendum, that the peace camp would certainly win. So he's got his big idea, which is that Israel should boycott the EU, preempt any kind of trade sanctions from Europe.
And put itself in a very strong position, it would presume.
I want to get this in, if we've got a short time left with you, Ben, which is the final boycott on our smorgasbord of boycotts for this morning. Two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, but not if you're in the West Bank town of Ariel.
But Ariel is the kind of one of the largest settlements in the West Bank. It's sort of positioned deep in the mountaintops, overlooking the Jordan Valley. And the McDonald's franchise in Israel has refused to open up there. And this has caused a furore of anger amongst the religious and settler community, which are calling for McDonald's to itself be boycotted. And this is just another step in McDonald's kind of difficult history of establishing itself in the land of Israel. McDonald's arrived very, very late. There was like lots of difficulty over whether or not it could be considered kosher. It's never really taken off to the same degree as it has in other Mediterranean countries.
A tragedy for all burger lovers. It's not really, is
not
it?
Really,
it's
not really.
Not at all. Ben Judah, thank you very much for coming in. Ben, of course, is the author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Coming up, we'll be in Germany, where the campaign is starting to get ugly.
Get ready to go deep underground, because beneath our feet are some of the greatest engineering marvels on the planet. All this week on the Globalist and Globalist Asia programs, we'll be donning the hard hat for our series all about tunnels. From the longest tunnel in the world, currently under construction through the Swiss Alps, to the construction site at the bottom of the Bosphorus. Yeah, you know they're gonna bring him down now. We'll be hitching a ride with one of the giant diggers burrowing its way under London for the Crossrail project. And we'll also be traversing a dangerous network of tunnels in the Middle East to find out what it's like smuggling not only goods, but people in and out of the Gaza Strip. I'm going deeper underground. So join us all this week for our special series on tunnels around the world. That's on The Globalist at 1400 hours in Tokyo, 0600 hours in London, and 2200 hours in Los Angeles.
And it's just right now turned 8:18 in London, which means it's 9:18 in Berlin, where things have been turning dirty, at least as far as the general election campaign is a concern, because it's just weeks away now before the big vote. And if you believe the polls, Angela Merkel is set to hold on to her position extremely comfortably. Faced with a 30-point gulf in approval ratings, the SPD challenger Per Steinbrück has released the attack dogs, or at least one attack dog, in the shape of Andrea Nahles, the SPD's election strategist-in-chief.
Yes, and according to Nahles, Angela Merkel is, and I quote, lacking any vision other than hanging on to power. She's not convincing, and deep inside, she's empty. Ouch, say what you think, Andrea. So is the SPD's new tactic a political masterstroke, or is characterising the Chancellor as a policy-stealing power-grabber only likely to make their predicament even messier? Well, the Financial Times Berlin editor is Quentin Peel, and he joins us on the line now. Quentin, welcome back to the show. This is pretty strong stuff, isn't it?
Well, I think it's an illustration of just how frustrated the Social Democrats are. There's this woman, Angela Merkel, who sits there and fundamentally doesn't appear to have any vision and any really clear policy, and yet she steals theirs, and she's fantastically popular as a result. So they're incredibly frustrated.
Well, isn't this just what competent politicians are meant to do, though?
Yes, Merkel is particularly good at it. They have a weird and wonderful phrase to describe her tactics, and they call it asymmetric demobilization. And what they mean by that is she sort of deadens all the issues so that people don't really get upset about them. And if she can make it so that her opponents are the ones who stay at home and don't bother to vote, but at least her supporters come out because they like her, then she wins in the end. But I must say one thing. Although on the face of it, she's miles in front, the reality is she needs a partner. And if she hasn't got a coalition partner, she could be actually much, much closer to losing office. It could come down to 1 or 2 percentage points at the end of the day.
Quentin, well, let's take a look at the SPD's tactics then. I gave a few choice quotes from them in that introduction there. I mean, it does sound pretty dirty from here. How has it gone down with the electorate thus far?
Well, they've produced these campaign posters, the SPD, all of them focused on Merkel looking bored or frustrated, or she's searching in her handbag for a mobile phone. It's a very high-risk strategy because she is popular, and if they are seen to be mocking somebody who actually represents, I think this is the key to Chancellor Merkel's success, she represents what the Germans want to be themselves. Somebody without a very heavy-handed, clear strategy, somebody who solves problems and gets on with life and is reassuring. That's how they see themselves, and that's why they like her. So if the opposition, the Social Democrats, who've after all got a much less attractive candidate in Peer Steinbrück, if they're seen as knocking all the time, I think it could actually lose them votes.
Of course, everybody around Europe is also looking at this election. And there was a sense in certain parts of Europe, I mean, notably in West Balkans, where I'm normally based, that you had to get things done before this election, that it was so important, Germany's view of what was going on in terms of EU expansion, that you needed to get things worked out before the election happened. How is Europe playing in Germany at the moment, bearing in mind this enormous role that Germany's been playing?
Yes, well, really interesting. The European issue is not a big issue in this election. It's one, something that all the parties except for two agree on. And the only two that don't agree are the far-left Linke, who basically say the entire European crisis is the fault of the banks, nationalise all the banks and or make them go bankrupt and we'll be better off. And this tiny little Eurosceptic party called the Alternative for Germany. And they could steal a few percentage points off Miss Merkel and her partners, the Liberals. Now, having said that, it's not a big issue. Outside Germany, the German election is a huge issue. Everybody's waiting to see the result. And I think what they're praying for is that the result will be, if you like, a stalemate where Angela Merkel is forced to bring the Social Democrats into government and they will be more socially inclined and go for growth. And that's what everybody else in Europe is desperate to see from Germany, more growth. And that's really why I think everybody is just waiting for the election.
Quentin Peel, Financial Times' Berlin editor. Always interesting to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today on Midori House.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, from the cobbled streets of Notting Hill to the tout-packed pavements of Brick Lane, London is a city designed for pedestrians. And going by the latest Transport for London report, it's become even more so. Over the past 10 years, there's been a 12% rise in daily trips made by Shanks's pony, meaning a third of Londoners now choose to walk to destinations as far as 30 minutes away.
Deary me. That is all part of a walking plan, capital W, capital P, initiated by former London Mayor Ken Livingstone. He pledged to turn the British capital into a walkable city. Since then, some of his plans have been implemented by the current mayor, Boris Johnson, and the city's walkonomics have been hailed a success. But is London as pedestrian-friendly as Transport for London suggests? Well, Monocle's Daphne Denis put the question to Tom Platt. He's the London manager of Living Streets, a charity for pedestrians, as they took a little walk around East London.
In 2004, Ken Livingstone said that he was going to make London a walkable city. Do you think back then London wasn't a walkable city and why?
I don't think London wasn't a walkable city then any more than I don't think it is or isn't now. I think London's got some great streets to walk in, some great architecture, beautiful parks, really interesting street life and kind of character on the streets, which means it's a really interesting place to walk. But it also has, back then and now, some really awful places to walk. Some of our most iconic places like Oxford Street or Parliament Square are still really bad places to walk. So whilst there have been some good things that happened in London over the last, you know, 6-7 years, there's also been a lot of stuff that could have been done that hasn't been done to improve it.
What are those things that should have been done and haven't been done?
I think London has lacked a bit of a vision for the recent kind of years. Ken did set up a walking plan when he was in. That was actually scrapped by the current mayor. We now have no walking vision in place. We have no walking targets to improve or increase the amount of walking like we previously had. In fact, we had a year of walking in 2011, which is actually scrapped altogether by the mayor and TfL. So I think the first thing we need is a really ambitious vision that says what the mayor's going to do to increase walking and improve the quality of walking. Then alongside that, there's things like we need to tackle and make London streets as safe as possible. The biggest thing to do there is actually reduce vehicle speeds, because that's the thing that makes the biggest difference to London's, the safety of our streets. So we've been pushing 20 mile an hour campaign for a number of years now, and the Transport for London have started to introduce 20 miles an hour on some of the main roads where there's lots of people and lots of activity. And boroughs like Islington have already got a default 20 mile an hour speed limit on all borough roads, and that's now been followed very recently by Camden and Southwark. So that's kind of happening, which is a really positive thing. Giving people information is really important, and one of the good things that they've done in London recent years is legible London signs. So that's having consistent signage on bus stops, on the kind of, they're called monoliths, those signs you see with the yellow tops in London. And that's really important, because often people don't realise how easy it is to walk. You know, it's only a 5-minute walk. In fact, I think it's about half of journeys in London made by car are between 0.5 of a kilometre and 2 kilometres, so that, you know, really walkable distances. So we need to tell people about walking routes, and we need to improve the quality of those routes so people will walk and have all the benefits in terms of pollution to their health, reducing congestion and all those things.
There is a report though that says that the number of Londoners walking has increased 12%, I think, between 2001 and 2012. So In effect, there's numbers saying that more Londoners are walking. What do you say to that?
My feeling is, although I'm not 100% sure, but my feeling is that that's to do with population increases. If you actually look at the percentage of walking journeys compared to other walking modes, it hasn't gone up in the last 15 or so or more years. About 30% of trips made by Londoners on a daily basis are by foot, and that number hasn't gone up, whereas population has increased by, you know, a certain percent, which has kind of meant there's been an increase of walking trips. It isn't to say walking isn't really important. In fact, 6.2 million trips a day are made on foot, making it the biggest transport mode. And that's why, and all the other journeys people make for public transport, for example, virtually all of them include an element of walking. So it's super important. And that's why we need to have a really strong vision, and the mayor really thinking about it and caring about it, and be done in a strategic and a proper way, and investment in it and a priority given towards it, because good things are happening, but it could be a whole lot better, and we need to benchmark ourselves against the best cities in the world.
The current mayor is famous for implementing Boris bikes. Boris Johnson is like associated with the Boris bike. So what can he do to become walking Boris, I guess?
Well, the first thing would be for him to stand up and say, I want to be walking Boris. I think what's been great about cycling, and we're really supportive of it, is that the mayor has stood up and said, I want to make cycling better in London, I want to make it safer, I want more people to cycle. Once he does that, it means Transport for London and the boroughs and people around him, you know, go to work on how that can happen. What we don't have at the moment is him saying that. So the first thing would be for him to kind of stand up and champion walking and set out a vision. After that, we can start getting down to the detail of how you make our streets safer, how you encourage more people to walk, how you promote walking. For example, we run the Walk to School campaign, which is a really effective tool at getting more children to walk to school. And that's something that can be done at, you know, relatively cheaply and has huge benefits in terms of safety on the route to school, getting children fitter, improving air pollution on the way to school and things like that. So there's lots of things you can do, just need to kind of have that vision at the beginning and the ambition to do it.
And so according to you, from Living Streets, which city do you think has the best walkable, the most walkable streets?
I think there's so many great places to walk in. Many of the Scandinavian cities just have a lower car use and more people walking, cycling, so that certainly helps. And then there's many, you know, I personally love going into Italy and the Italian cities because, you know, how beautiful they are and the architecture and the kind of design of the streets. But I think walking in London is a great thing to do, and I think London is a great city to walk in, but it's about how we can take that to the next level and make it even better.
Tom Platt of the charity Living Streets was having a walk and a talk with Monocle's Daphne Denis.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll roam the streets of Istanbul. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Guy. It's claimed that a series of American embassy closures in the Middle East and Africa was prompted by an Al-Qaeda threat picked up through intercepting messages between terrorist commanders in Yemen and Pakistan. The New York Times says the intercepted messages were between Osama bin Laden's successor and the head of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Three people have been killed and three others wounded after a gunman fired on a public meeting in a government building in rural Pennsylvania. Police say the suspected gunman was arrested at the scene. A Sudanese soldier has been killed in a clash with soldiers from South Sudan. An official statement said the clash took place after a South Sudanese patrol crossed the border and opened fire. The founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has agreed to buy the newspaper assets of the Washington Post for $250 million. The Post chairman and chief executives, Donald E. Graham, whose family owns the paper, said it would be better served with another owner. Bezos is promising no radical change. Police in the Canadian province of New Brunswick say a snake has escaped from a pet shop and strangled two young boys believed to be brothers aged 5 and 7. The boys had been staying in a friend's apartment above the shop in Campbellton. The highest paid player in the American Baseball League, New York Yankees Alex Rodriguez, has been suspended for a record 211 games for alleged doping offences. The ban lasts until the end of the 2014 season, and it's estimated it could cost him around $35 million. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama to Amsterdam
to Cairo
to Karachi
to Bogota, all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Guy Delaunay, and Dominic Reynolds.
Now, this week's Section D sees its producer and current presenter, no less, Ali John, embark on an exploration of Istanbul. Site of recent popular protests, of course, at government autocracy, Ali travelled to the city to discover the origins of the unrest, rather, in an architectural and urban design protest at a proposed development on the city's central Gezi Park.
This protest and what's happened since frame a two-week special Monocle investigation into the historic and current state of architecture and urban planning in the city. And Alad is right across from me now in front of a microphone. Hello, Alad.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks.
Good to see you.
I'm excited to hear about your trip.
It was an exciting trip.
So what was the quest? You were going to the heart of the protests and seeing what design implications there were.
Yeah, obviously, on Section D, our focus is architecture, urban design, that kind of thing. And it struck me that 2 months after the protest kicked off, that people had kind of forgotten about what the origin of the protest was. So I thought, this is a good opportunity for us, on the architecture team at least, to look at why the protest first began and obviously why it had such traction and has led to 2 months' worth of much more widespread and much more aggressive protests, which have seen over 7 deaths and many, many injured and untold arrests. And, you know, the implications have kind of spiraled.
Yeah, and I mean, we've obviously talked plenty about exactly what the Turkish government is or isn't doing, and the problems that Erdogan's people are having. But I mean, we can sort of view all of this through a sort of urban planning prism, can't we?
We can, and as the first show opens with, I spent a lot of time investigating who I could speak to kind of get a good idea of what the protest was originally like. So I found a number of architects and urban designers who were involved in the original protest, which took place on May the 28th. This was in response to a government, a drive to redevelop Gezi Park. In a moment, we'll hear a clip of that tour that I was given by a local architect. But the significance of Gezi Park is one which is quite complex. It was founded, set up, and designed by Henri Prost, who's an architect who, he was of great prominence. He was kind of brought on after the Ottoman Empire by Ataturk. He then designed the central Gezi Park in honor of the second president, İnönü. So it holds a lot of kind of antagonistic wealth against the government. Erdogan sees it as a kind of threat. It's the location for the May the 1st Labor Day protests. That's obviously a left movement. Erdogan's government is a conservative government. So there's all this kind of historical potency which underlies the current protests. But yeah, as we'll hear now, Murat Çetin, he's an architect. He gave me a tour of Gezi Park, and I was interested to find out how it began as what was termed a pedestrianization project, which sounds quite a nice thing. Began such a kind of vibrant protest.
The government is very talented and very conscious about the use of catchy words like pedestrianization. Yes, it sounds very good, but the actual project was not a pedestrianization project at all. Because in order to take the massive traffic here, you need to excavate approximately 6 major tunnels around the square. And they have to be at least 2 lane each. And if you look at the streets and the width of the streets, you can see that they are not that big. So once these tunnels are excavated all around the square, for pedestrians, there is only about 1.5 meters to walk. So it is not realistic to attract people in terms of providing pedestrianization.
Is that not during the excavation process? Or the finished product surely
Finished product was going to provide major tunnels, so the leftover space for pedestrians was going to be 1.5 meters wide.
But the tunnels, would they not have a roof? Would you not be able to walk over the tunnels? Would they be underground entirely, or would they be open tunnels?
In order to be able to allow the cars to enter, you need at least about 20-30 meters of open area. So all these connections from the surrounding was going to be cut. I think these are deliberate acts of gentrifying this area and removing its ties with the surrounding settlements, and especially those people who are not very accepted by the government.
So looking at the events that happened over the last 2 months,
yes.
How involved were you in the events?
I was from the day one within the protests, because we started the protests not for these trees only, because of the whole public works project going on around Taksim Square. We were defending the public space, because all these transformations, and especially the shopping mall project, was kind of destroying the public nature of the park. So we were protesting against that.
And that's architect Murat Çetin talking to the man across from me, Alad. Alad, did Murat give you any ideas of whether they sort of deliberately tried to engage this great mass of people who ended up with this enormous protest?
As in, did the police, did the government want to engage with them violently?
Well, did the architects and the urban planners, were they hoping to turn this into the kind of mass protest that it became?
There genuinely wasn't a sense of that. I mean, it was still a fairly substantial protest from the outset, but it happened. The thing with Turkey, as I can tell you from now, from first-hand experience, those protests escalate at an alarming rate. We were caught in one on Wednesday, which, you know, was ostensibly a press conference given in Taksim Square by the mother of a guy who was in a coma thanks to a tear gas attack. And that escalated within 15 minutes from her giving a press conference to police firing rubber bullets at, not us, but we were in the crowd looking at what was going on, to water cannons, to tear gas. So the original protest on the 28th of May, was a peaceful sit-in. It was a peaceful sit-in which carried on overnight. The police raided it at 5 in the morning, and you didn't hear it then, but later on in that interview, I asked Munetz, were you expecting the reaction from the police and the government to be so fierce? And he said, well, no, not at all, because they were protesting against the felling of three trees initially. I mean, obviously, that is the kind of the tip of the iceberg, but it was three trees that caused them to take that stand in the first instance.
I wonder, like, looking at Turkey more, looking at Istanbul, rather, more generally, there's obviously, we've been talking about all of the complaints that have been related to the endless building of shopping malls and the development of the skyline and the gentrification, essentially. And gentrification is being linked with this sort of historical kind of revisionism. And I wonder if it's possible to separate them. Is there a type of gentrification that could be going on in Istanbul that people wouldn't protest about so much because it was a bit more culturally respectful?
There is. Obviously, there is a type of gentrification which could be used there, but this is a construction-led boom in Turkey that's going on. It's a construction-led gentrification, so it's an imposed, really quick rush through gentrification. Everyone that we spoke to, I mean, to give a picture of what we're coming up on the show briefly, because I know we haven't got that much time, I wanted to cover the original protest. I also wanted to paint a picture of what life is like as an architect to be in that city. And it, to be honest, it's quite an alarming picture. The government will act with impunity and give out punitive treatment to people who dissent from their line of thought. So the Chamber of Architects is a constitutional organisation, for instance, that was involved in the protests. They have now been not disbanded, but they've been removed from planning protocol, which is an unprecedented move and takes away that barrier, that protection of the public and from developers. It's quite interesting stuff going on there.
Fascinating. It seems that if you're the people who have anything unpleasant to say, shut up. That seems to be the message that is coming across.
Unfortunately, that is the sense.
Aled, thanks very much. You can hear more on the origins of the recent Turkey protests as eloquently trailed by Aled there on tonight's Section D. It premieres tonight. What time, Aled?
1900 hours London time.
There we go.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with more from Turkey.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time. And you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes. Oh, and the answers are knit, yes, ask the Japanese, San Francisco, where else, the Caracas poor on the up, and a greener than thou Malmo hood. Urbanist listeners, don't look too smug. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:43 here in London, which means it's 10:43 in Turkey's capital, Ankara.
And we're staying in Turkey to discuss the latest news coming out of Istanbul. Caleb Lauer is our man there. He joins us on the line now. Caleb, welcome back to Midori House. There's really only one big story in Turkey at the moment, isn't there?
Well, that's right. In terms of headline events, in terms of the topics people are talking about, there is certainly one story today. Yesterday, the Ergenekon trial finally delivered its verdict, which resulted in extremely heavy sentences for about 250 people, all charged with being members of a terrorist organization. And now we don't have to say alleged terrorist organization anymore, because according to the government, now that the court has decided that there was a terrorist organization, there was, in fact, a terrorist organization. Now, the only complicating factor to this is that the trial itself did not really clarify exactly what that terrorist organization consisted of. Nevertheless, about 250 people will be spending time in jail, including 17 people with life sentences, and others, including journalists and members of parliament, have been sentenced to tens of years.
But it seems that a lot of people in Turkey are viewing the trial in some ways as a failure.
Absolutely. This trial was, without a doubt, dysfunctional. Just to give you a sense, I wasn't at the verdict yesterday. They weren't letting people near the courthouse. But I did visit a hearing a few months ago, one of the penultimate hearing, I think. And it within 5 minutes of the hearing opening, the lawyers were on the tables screaming at the judge, who called in the riot cops, who beat a lawyer so badly he had to visit the ambulance after. This is the scene at the courthouse, and it's been like that for years. There's a camp permanently set up outside the courthouse. Yesterday, police fired tear gas at people trying to cross the cornfield to get to the courthouse, setting the field on fire. It's been a real disaster, and that's just the optics. The procedure itself has been questioned by experts, including the European Court of Human Rights.
Well, Caleb, clearly lots of international eyes watching, but I mean, the article that I had a look at this morning from the Hurriyet Daily News described this trial as the most important legal battle in recent Turkish history. Explain to us, if you can, exactly why it's so important.
Well, there's two things to say. On paper, definitely this could have been one of the most important trials in the Turkish Republic's history. But it was a missed opportunity in many ways. What the trial was aiming to do was to uncover an illegal organization that was set up within the state itself. These are people that are characterized by their ultra-nationalism, their ultra-Turkish secular republican ideology, that were opposed very much to the government of the AK Party, which is a Islamist-oriented party, which is seen as counter to the tenets of the republic. So when the government came into power in 2002, this group that many say had been in place for years before, in fact stemming from the 50s, this is a very, very old organization, obviously with new people, but this group activated itself in a way so as to create chaos in the country, to assassinate people, all with the intent of creating enough chaos so that a coup d'etat would have been necessary. Now, the fact that this is about a coup against the government is one thing. The other thing is that it is about illegal activities within the state itself, regardless of the purpose, regardless of the intent. These things do happen in Turkey, and everybody recognizes them as fact. There have been so many incidents that demonstrate this. But the fact is that this trial could have revealed those things, could have illustrated the networks and how they worked, but in fact it didn't. It just convicted people with arguments that simply didn't make sense to many experts.
And the chance of revealing what's going on behind the curtains in Turkey seems to be receding almost by the day, especially if you're a Turkish journalist, because if you say anything against the governing party, you seem to be at risk of getting fired these days.
Exactly, and this has been happening more and more, or I shouldn't say more and more, it's been happening more and more visibly since Gezi Park on Friday. One of Turkey's most well-known, famous, respected journalists, a man named Can Dündar, was fired from Milliyet. And Milliyet is a major paper in Turkey. And before him, just a week or two before him, another man named Yavuz Baydar was fired from his position as the ombudsman for Sabah. Now, Sabah is a huge newspaper, of course, and it's run by people very, very close to Erdogan. But this pattern has been continuing and continuing and continuing. There's something like 70 people that have lost their jobs since Gezi alone. And what's important to note is that the process or the phenomenon of journalists being fired in Turkey is not something that spiked after Gezi. I would say it's probably something at a fairly even rate. It's just that we didn't hear a lot about it before. We did hear about it, but not as much as we've been hearing about it. The pressure on the press is becoming outstanding.
Caleb, just before you go, one last story. Let's talk figures. Turkish inflation has risen to a 10-month high, I'm told.
Yeah, that's the economic news, of course, and it's a very important piece of economic news. But in Turkey, it should be said that inflation is not just an economic indicator, it's also a political indicator. Everybody, let's say over the age of 20, will remember that Turkey has been in, for most of its existence, a high inflationary environment, 50% inflation in a year, 100% inflation in a year. Now, the one of the major successes that the AK Party has had since it came into power is a managing of the inflation rate below 10%. So this is a major political victory for the party, and people are very, very worried what happens when it goes back. Now, inflation is up, which means that ultimately interest rates are going to have to go up. The central bank doesn't have enough reserve currency to defend the lira, which is the ultimate cause of this inflation, the depreciation of the lira. So we're going to see interest rates going up. Now, that's very important in an election season, which we're entering, because Erdogan, the Prime Minister Erdogan, is very much opposed to interest rates going up. In fact, the interest rate lobby was one of his main culprits for the Gezi Park and Taksim Square protests. So the fact that the central bank is going to be, required to raise these interest rates in an election season when the Prime Minister has been, violently condemning the so-called interest rate lobby is going to be a very interesting thing to watch.
Well, indeed, interesting times generally in Turkey at the moment. That was Caleb Lauer. Thanks very much, Caleb. Our man in Istanbul. And since we've spent quite a bit of time in the Turkish peninsula today, we thought we'd better play some music from there too. This is Hande Yener with her hit, Ya Ya Ya.
That is some pop from Turkey. It's by Hande Yener, and it's called Ya Ya Ya.
Do you think we heard enough of that?
No, I could have done with another minute, but, you know, we've got to get to Sophie, haven't we?
Well, fair enough. You are listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and Dominic Reynolds, and it's time now to look at the British front pages with our senior editor, Sophie Grove. Hello, Sophie.
Hello, good to see you.
Now, what is going on in the British front pages?
So, The Telegraph, unsurprisingly, and many of the British papers are running with a story about Gibraltar, because we've seen lots and lots of queues on the border or the crossing into Gibraltar from Spain, and it's becoming very heated, especially in some of the rhetoric we're seeing. The party is over, declared the Spanish foreign minister. Not quite sure which party he's referring to.
Yeah, I don't remember that party in Gibraltar. But the Rock.
Exactly. But the Rock has been it's been disputed for 300 years. But it's just such an interesting shift in relations between Spain and the UK, because the governor of Gibraltar has started really using some heavy language here, talking about our own foreign secretary has talked about standing shoulder to shoulder in this very sort of warmongering way. But then we're looking at Fabian Picardo talking about comparing Spain to North Korea.
Interesting.
And also comparing the Spanish government to the Franco era.
We've been hearing that, yeah, quite a bit, haven't we? As the rhetoric inflates, there's sort of insults fly, and then we go, "Well, you're behaving like Franco," so there.
Exactly, but he's defending these comments. He says, "As for comparing Spain to North Korea, North Korea has a reputation for making left-field comments, which is quite off." And that's just how I see it. It's like, okay,
it's quite a weird defence, isn't it? You compare someone to North Korea, but no, not because of that stuff, just because they make left-field comments sometimes.
His defence, everyone's on the attack. It's very, it seems very complex, and it's all to do with an artificial reef project in Camp Bay, which is being put together by the Gibraltar administration. And the Spanish fishermen say that's going to have a huge impact on their fishing rights. So they're going to levy this 50 euro charge to get in to Gibraltar to compensate those fishermen. So that's where we stand at the moment. But it can only get worse, it seems.
The thing is that, you know, the European Union, or many of the European Union countries, have left themselves in a terrible position in terms of self-determination for places like Gibraltar by recognising Kosovo. And interestingly, of course, Spain is one of the five European Union member countries which hasn't done that because of all its secessionist movements and, of course, little old Gibraltar sitting there off the bottom end. And you wonder how they're going to get out of this conundrum.
You're absolutely right, because self-determination in this case has been almost completely unanimous for the Gibraltese, because they're, you know, mostly sort of Union Jack waving expats, well, in spirit. So it's quite a complex one, and you're quite right. We've seen a couple of referendums quite recently. So it'll be interesting to see where this heads.
Okay. The next big question, of course, is who is going to fill the big and very shiny shoes of Silvio Berlusconi? And apparently it might be his daughter.
Exactly. There's a great profile of Marina Berlusconi today in the FT, page 4, looking at the eldest of his five children from two marriages. She's 47 this Saturday. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, yeah. Marina. But I wonder how you'll celebrate some sort of lavish bunga bunga party.
But it's quite interesting because obviously we've seen this definitive conviction for tax fraud upheld by the Supreme Court last week in Italy. Berlusconi himself, Silvio, looks like he will face some serious charges. I mean, a lot of people are lobbying for a presidential pardon, but you know, his party is looking for a new leader. He's been in charge for the last 20 years of the People of Liberty Party. They're about to change their name to Forza Italia. Oh, go
changing
Italy.
Changing it back, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's back to its original, so back to the future, maybe.
But it's just such an interesting question that, you know, we might see a kind of inherited situation here. From a woman, to a woman who hasn't really expressed any political inclinations at all. And she's actually rebuffed the idea of an inherited sort of political situation in the past. And she said there is an abyss between following politics and engaging directly, a gap I have never remotely thought of bridging.
Well, it sort of seems to make sense, doesn't it? I mean, I'm only slightly joking with the giant shiny shoes analogy for Silvio Berlusconi, because it's an enormous name, an enormous reputation to fill, almost something that can't be filled by a traditional political changeover. It would need to be something almost dynastic.
Exactly, a paper that's owned by Berlusconi says about her, "We know that she does not want it, but we are afraid that this is now her turn."
This is going down the route that we've seen in the United States with their Kennedy, Bush, and increasingly Clinton dynasties. India, of course, we've seen the great political dynasties there. Same with Bangladesh. It seems to be a temptation for many countries which are republics that they somehow want to substitute a royal family in there.
Exactly. It's a curious situation.
I'm not savoury, really, is
and
it?
And she's not available for comment. She's on holiday.
Oh, shucks. We tried. Sophie, before you go, Bob Dylan's art. Is it any good?
Frankly, no. A lot of reviews today in the papers, so check those out.
OK, but don't check out the art, it would seem. Our senior editor is Sophie Grove. Sophie, thank you very much for joining us.
And that is all we have time for today. That flew. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, and our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Zoe Tennant, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, is The Entrepreneurs. I'll be back with Phil Han with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Guy Delaunay.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.